Chapter 11. Dirk walked across the room. The laser rifle was leaning up against the wall. He lifted it, felt once again the vaguely oily texture of the slick black plastic. His thumb brushed over the wolf's head. He raised the weapon to his shoulder, sighted, fired. The wand of light hung for at least a full second in the air. He moved the rifle slightly, and the pencil beam moved with it. When it faded, and the afterimage left his retinas, he saw that he had burned an uneven hole in the window. The wind was whistling through it loudly, making an odd dissonance with the music of Lamia Bayliss. Gwen climbed unsteadily out of her bed. What? Dirk? He shrugged at her and lowered the rifle. What? She repeated. What are you doing? I wanted to make sure I knew how it worked, he explained. I'm going. She frowned. Wait, she said. I'll find my boots. He shook his head. You too? Her face was hard, ugly. I don't need to be protected, damn it. It's not like that, he said. If this is some idiot move to make yourself a hero in my eyes, it isn't going to work, she said, putting her hands on her hips. He smiled. What this is, Gwen, is some idiot move to make myself a hero in my eyes. Your eyes aren't important anymore. Why then? He hefted the rifle uncertainly. I don't know, he admitted. Maybe because I like Jan and owe him. Because I want to make it up to him for running out after he trusted me and named me Keth. Dirk, she began. He waved her quiet. I know, but that isn't all. Maybe I just want to get Ruark. Maybe it's because Crying Lamia has more suicides than any other festival city, and I'm one of them. You can pick your own motive, Gwen. All of the above. A faint smile brushed across his face. Maybe it's because there are only 12 stars, you know? So it doesn't make any difference, does it? What good can you possibly do? Who knows? Why does it matter? Do you care, Gwen? Do you really? He shook his head, and the motion sent his hair tumbling over his forehead once again. So once more he had to stop and brush it back. I don't care if you care, he said forcefully. You said or implied I was being selfish back in Challenge. Well, maybe I was, and maybe I am now. I'll tell you something, though. Whatever I'm going to do, I'm not asking to look at your arms first, Gwen. Know what I mean? It was a fine exit line, but halfway out of the door he softened, hesitated, turned back. Stay here, Gwen, he told her. Just stay. You're still hurt. If you have to run, Jan said something about a cave. You know anything about a cave? She nodded. Well, go there if you have to. Otherwise, stay here. He waved a clumsy farewell at her with the rifle, then spun and walked away too quickly. Down in the air lot, the walls were just walls. No ghosts, no murals, no lights. Dirk stumbled over the air car he wanted in the dark, then waited while his eyes adjusted. His derelict was no product of High Cavalan. It was a cramped two-seater, a black and silver teardrop of plastic and lightweight metal. No armor at all, of course, and the only weapon it carried was the laser rifle he laid across his lap. It was only a little less dead than the rest of Warlorn, but that little was enough. When he tapped into the power, the car woke, and the instruments lit the cabin with their pale radiance. He ate a protein bar quickly and studied the readings. The energy supply was low, too low, but it would have to do. He would not use the headlamps. He could fly by the scant starlight, and the heater was likewise to be dispensed with, as long as he had his leather jacket to keep him from the chill. Dirk slammed down the door, sealing himself in, and flicked on the gravity grid. The air car lifted, rocking a bit unsteadily, but it lifted. He gripped the stick and threw it forward, and then he was outside and airborne. He had one brief flash of terror. If the grid had been feeble enough, he knew there would be no flight at all, just a rolling rumble to the moss-choked ground below. The air car throbbed and dipped alarmingly once clear of the lot, but only for an instant. Then the grid caught hold and they rode up in the singing winds, and the only thing left tumbling was his stomach. Dirk climbed steadily, trying to push the small car as high as it would go. The mountain wall was ahead, and he had to clear it. Besides, he was not anxious to encounter other nocturnal flyers. High up, with his lights doused, he could see any other air cars that passed below him, but the chances were good that he would escape their notice. He did not look back at Crine Lamia, but he felt the city behind him, driving him onward, washing away his fears. Fear was so foolish, nothing mattered, death least of all. Even when the siren city and its white and grey lights were gone, the music lingered, steadily fading and growing weaker, but always with him, always potent. One note, a thin, wavering whistle, outlasted the rest. Some 30 kilometers from the city he was still hearing it, mixed with a deeper whistle of the wind. Finally he realized that the noise was coming from his own lips. He stopped whistling and tried to concentrate on flying. When he had been airborne for almost an hour, the mountain wall bulked up before him, or rather beneath him, for he was quite high by that time, and he felt closer to the stars and the pinpoint galaxies above than to the forests far below. The wind had grown shrill and furious as it forced its way through the hairline cracks in the door seam, but Dirk was ignoring the sound. Where the mountains met the wilderness, he saw a light. He banked the air car, circled, and began to descend. No lights should shine this side of the mountains, he knew. Whatever it was, it should be investigated. He spiraled down until he was directly above the light, then stilled all forward motion of the air car, hung hovering for a short moment, and faded his gravity grid. With infinite slowness, he settled, rocking back and forth slightly in the wind, falling quietly. There were several lights beneath him. The main source of illumination was a fire. He could tell that now. He could see it shifting and flickering as the winds fanned the flames this way and that. But there were other, smaller lights as well, steady and artificial, a circle of them off in the blackness, not terribly distant from the fire. Perhaps a kilometer, he estimated, perhaps less. The temperature in the small cabin began to rise, and Dirk felt sweat on his skin, soaking his clothing beneath the heavy jacket. Smoke assaulted him as well, clouds of it, black and sooty, rose from the fire and obscured his view. Frowning, he moved the air car until he was no longer directly above the blaze, and continued to descend. The flames rose up to greet him, long orange tongues, very bright against the plumes of smoke. He saw sparks as well, or embers, or something of that sort. They issued from the fire in hot, bright showers, shooting off into the night and then vanishing. Drifting lower, he was treated to yet another display, a furious crackling of blue-white flame that came with a sharp scent of ozone and then was gone again. Dirk stopped the air car dead when the fire was still decently below him. There were other people about, the circle of steady artificial lights, and he did not care to be seen. His black and silver air car, motionless against the black sky, would not be easy to spot, but it would be a different story if he let himself be outlined by the flames. Although he had an unobstructed view from where he hovered, he still could not make out what was burning. The center of the fire was a shapeless darkness from which the sparks issued periodically. Around it he could see the dense tangle of chokers, their waxy limbs shining bright yellow in the reflected glare. Several had fallen into the heart of the conflagration and were contributing most of the black smoke as they shriveled and turned to ash. But the rest, the twisting fence that surrounded the black burning thing, refused to go up. Instead of spreading, the fire was visibly dying out. Dirk waited and watched it die. He was already fairly certain that he was looking at a fallen air car. The sparks and ozone smell told him that much. He wanted to know which air car. After the flames had dwindled and the sparks had ceased to storm, but before the fire had gutted out entirely and turned to greasy smoke, Dirk saw a shape. Briefly, a wing, vaguely bat-like, twisted at a grotesque angle and poking toward the sky, a sheet of fire flaring behind it. That was enough. This was not any air car, he knew, though it was clearly of Kavalar manufacture. A dark ghost above the forest, he flitted away from the dying fire toward the ring of man-made illumination. This time he maintained a greater distance. He did not need to go closer. The lights were quite bright, and the scene was etched in fine detail. He saw a wide clearing, ringed by electric torches on the edge of some broad body of still water. Three air cars were down there, and he knew all three. The same trio had been down beneath the Amorelli tree within Challenge when Myrick Braith had assaulted Gwen. One of them, the great domed car with dark red armor, belonged to Lorimar Highbraith. The other two were smaller, almost identical, except they were identical no longer since one of them was visibly damaged, even seen from this distance. It was lying awkwardly, half submerged in the water, and part of it was misshapen and glowing. Its armored door gaped open. Stick figures moved about the wreck. Dirk would hardly have seen them at all except for their motion, so well did they blend with the background. Nearby, someone was leading Braith hounds from a gate in the flank of Lorimar's air car. Frowning, Dirk touched his grid control and took his own car straight up, until the men and air cars were lost to sight and nothing remained below but a point of light in the forest. 2 points, in truth, but the fire was a faint orange ember now, visibly fading. Safe in the black womb of sky, he paused to think. The damaged air car had been Rosev's, the same car they had stolen in Challenge, the car Jan Vickery had flown to Lartain that morning. He was sure of that. The Braiths had found him, clearly, and pursued him to the forest, lasered him down. But it seemed unlikely that he was dead. Otherwise, why the Braith hounds? Lorimar wasn't just taking his pack for a walk. It was more than likely that Jan had survived to flee into the forest, and that the Braiths were going to hunt him down. Dirk considered briefly trying to effect a rescue, but the prospect seemed dim. He had no idea how to find Jan in the night-shrouded outworld wild. The Braiths were better equipped for that than he was. He resumed his course toward the mountain wall and Lartain beyond. In the forest, armed and alone as he was, he could do Jan Vickery no particular good. In the Kavalar Firefort, however, he could at the very least settle Iron Jade's score with Arkin Ruark. The mountain slid beneath him, and Dirk relaxed once more, though one hand fell to rest on the laser rifle that still lay across his lap. The flight took just under an hour. Then Lartain, red and smouldering, shouldered up out of the mountains. It looked very dead, very empty, but Dirk knew that for a lie. He kept low, and wasted no time shooting straight across the low square rooftops and the glowstone plazas to the building he had once shared with Gwen Dolvano, the two Iron Jades, and the Kimdisi Liar. Only one other air car waited on the windswept roof, the armor-clad military relic. Of Ruark's small yellow flyer there was no sign, and the grey manta was missing as well. Dirk briefly wondered what had happened to it, abandoned back in Challenge, then shoved the thought aside as he descended for a landing. He kept the laser firmly in his grip as he climbed out. The world was still and crimson. He walked swiftly to the tubes and rode down to Ruark's quarters. They were empty. He searched them quite thoroughly, turning things this way and that, not caring what he disturbed, what he destroyed. All of the Kimdisi's belongings were still in place, but Ruark was not there, nor was there any sign of where he had gone. Dirk's own possessions remained as well, the few things he had left behind when he and Gwen had run, nothing but a small pile of light clothing he had brought from Brack, useless here in the chill of Warlorn. He set down the laser, knelt, and began to rummage through the pockets of the soiled pants. It was not until he found it, jammed away still in its wrapping of silver and velvet, that he really knew what he was looking for, and why he had come back to Lartain. In Ruark's bedroom he found a small cache of personal jewelry in a lockbox, rings, pendants, intricate bracelets and crowns, earrings of semi-precious stones. He pored through the box until he found a thin fine chain with a silver wire owl frozen in amber and suspended on a clip. It looked about the right size, that clip. Dirk tore away the amber in the owl and replaced them with the whisper jewel. Then he unsealed his jacket and his heavy shirt and hung the chain around his neck, so the cold red teardrop was next to his bare skin, whispering its whispers, promising its lies. The small stab of ice was painful against his chest, but that was all right. It was Jenny. Very shortly he grew used to it, and it passed. Salt tears rolled down his cheeks. He did not notice. He went upstairs. The workroom that Ruark had shared with Gwen was as cluttered as Dirk remembered it, but the Kandisi was not there. Nor was he to be found in the deserted apartment above that where Dirk had called Ruark from Challenge. There was only one more place to search. Quickly he climbed to the top of the tower. The door was open. He hesitated, then entered, holding his laser at the ready. The great living room was chaos and destruction. The view screen had been smashed or had exploded. Glass shards were everywhere. The walls were scarred by laser fire. The couch had been overturned and ripped in a dozen places, stuffing pulled out in great handfuls and scattered. Some of it had been thrown into the fireplace, where it contributed to the sodden, smoky mess that choked the hearth. One of the gargoyles, headless and upside down, leaned up against the base of the mantel. Its head, glowstone eyes and all, had been thrown into the sodden ashes of the fire. The air stank of wine and vomit. Garth Janicek was sleeping on the floor, shirtless, his red beard stained even redder by dribbled wine, his mouth hanging open. He smelt like the room. He was snoring loudly, and his laser pistol was still clutched in one hand. Dirk saw his shirt balled up and lying in a pool of vomit that Janicek had tried to mop at half-heartedly. He walked around carefully and took the laser out of Janicek's limp fingers. Vickery's Tain was not quite the iron Kavalar that Jan imagined him. Janicek's right arm was still bound by iron and glowstones. A few of the red-black jewels had been forced from their settings. The empty holes looked obscene. But most of the bracelet was intact, except where it was marred by long scratches. Janicek's forearm above the bracelet was also scarred. The scratches were deep and often continuous with those scored in the black iron. Arm and armlet both were caked in dried blood. Near Janicek's boot, Dirk saw the long blood-stained knife. He could imagine the rest. Drunk, no doubt, his left hand made awkward by his old wound, trying to pry the glowstones free, losing patience and stabbing wildly, dropping the blade in his pain and his rage. Stepping backward lightly, detouring around Janicek's damp shirt, Dirk paused in the doorframe, leveled his rifle, and shouted, "Gas!" Janicek did not stir. Dirk repeated his shout. This time the volume of snoring declined appreciably. Encouraged, Dirk stooped and picked up the nearest object at hand, a glowstone, and lofted it through the air at the Kavalar. It hit Janicek on the cheek. He sat up slowly, blinking. He saw Dirk and scowled at him. "Get up," Dirk said. He waved his laser. Janicek rose shakily to his feet, looked around for his own weapon. "You won't find it," Dirk told him. "I've got it here." Janicek's eyes were blurred and weary, but he had slept off most of his drunkenness. "Why are you here, Telerian?" he said slowly, in a voice tinged more by exhaustion than by wine. "Have you come to mock me?" Dirk shook his head. "No, I'm sorry for you." Janicek glared. "Sorry for me? You don't think you deserve pity? Look around you." "Careful," Janicek told him. "Jake me too much, Telerian, and I will discover if you have steel enough to fire that laser you hold so awkwardly." "Don't, Garth," Dirk said. "Please, I need your help." Janicek laughed, throwing back his head and roaring. When he had stopped, Dirk told him everything that had happened since Vickery killed Myrick Braith in Challenge. Janicek stood very stiffly as he listened, his arms crossed tightly across his bare, scarred chest. He laughed one more time when Dirk told him his conclusions about Ruark. "The manipulators of Kimdis," Janicek muttered. Dirk let him mutter, then finished his story. "So," Janicek demanded when he had concluded, "why do you think any of this is any matter to me?" "I guess I didn't think you'd let the Braith hunt Jan down like an animal," Dirk said. He has made himself an animal. By Braithlights, I suppose, Dirk replied. Are you a Braith? I am a Cavalar. Are all Cavalars the same now? He gestured toward the stone head of the gargoyle sitting on the fireplace. I see you take trophies now, just like Lorimar. Janasek said nothing. His eyes were very hard. Maybe I was wrong, Dirk said. But when I came in here and saw all this, it made me think. It made me think that maybe you did have some human feeling for the man who used to be your Tain. It reminded me that once you told me that you and Jan had a bond stronger than any I had ever known. I guess that was a lie, though. It was truth. Jan Vickery broke that bond. Gwen broke all the bonds between us years ago, Dirk said. But I came when she needed me. Oh, it turned out that she didn't really need me, and I came for a lot of selfish reasons, but I came. You can't rob me of that, Garth. I kept my promise. He paused. And I would not let anyone hunt her if I could stop them. It appears that we were bonded by something a lot stronger than your Cavalar iron and fire. Say what you want, Talarian. Your words change nothing. The idea of you keeping promises is ludicrous. What of your promises to Jan and myself? I betrayed them, Dirk said quickly. I know that. So you and I are even, Garth. I have betrayed no one. You are abandoning those who stood closest to you. Gwen, who was your crow Bethane, who slept with you and loved you and hated you all at once. And Jan, your precious Tain. I have never betrayed them, Janasek said hotly. Gwen betrayed both myself and the jade and silver she wore from the day she joined us. Jan deserted all that was decent in the way he slew Myrick. He ignored me, ignored the duties of iron and fire. I owe neither of them. You don't, do you? Beneath his shirt, Dirk could feel the whisper jewel hard against his skin, flooding him with words and memories, with a sense of the man he had once been. He was very angry. And that says it all, right? You don't owe them, so who cares? All your damn Cavalar bonds are, after all, debt and obligation. Traditions, old holdfast wisdom like the Codjuella and Mockman hunting. Don't think about them, just follow them. Rook was right about one thing. There is no love in any of you, except maybe Jan, and I'm not so sure about him. What the hell was he going to do if Gwen hadn't been wearing his bracelet? The same thing, really? And what about you? Would you have challenged Myrick just because he hurt Gwen, or was it because he damaged your jade and silver? Dirk snorted. Maybe Jan would have done the same thing, but not you, Janasek. You're as Cavalar as Lorimar himself, as stiff as Chell, or Bretan. Jan wanted to make his folk better, but I guess you were only along for a ride and didn't believe any of it for a minute. He yanked Janasek's laser out of his belt and flung it across the room with his free hand. Here, he shouted, lowering his rifle. Go hunt a mockman. Janasek, startled, snapped the weapon out of the air almost by reflex. He stood holding it clumsily and frowned. I could kill you now, Talarian, he said. Do that or do nothing, Dirk said. It's all the same. If you had ever really loved Jan... I do not love Jan, Janasek snapped, his face flushed. He is my Tain. Dirk let the Cavalar's words hang in the air for a long minute. He scratched his chin thoughtfully. Is? He said. You mean Jan was your Tain, don't you? Janasek's flush faded as suddenly as it had come. Beneath his beard, one corner of his mouth twitched in a manner that reminded Dirk of Bretan. His eyes shifted almost furtively, half ashamed, to the heavy iron bracelet that still hung about his bloodied forearm. You never did get all the glowstones out, did you? Dirk said gently. No, Janasek said. His voice was oddly soft. No, I did not. It means little, of course. The physical iron is nothing when the other iron is gone. But it's not gone, Garth, Dirk said. Jan spoke of you when we were together in Crine Lamia. I know. Maybe he feels himself iron-bound to Gwen, too, and maybe that is wrong. Don't ask me. All I know is that for Jan, the other iron is still there. He wore his iron and fire bracelet in Crine Lamia. He'll be wearing it when the Braith hounds tear him down, I imagine. Janasek shook his head. Talarian, he said. Your mother comes from Kimdis, I would vow. Yet I cannot resist you. You manipulate too well. He grinned. It was the old grin, the one he had flashed that morning when he aimed his laser at Dirk and asked if it alarmed him. Jan Vickery is my Tain, he said. What do you want me to do? Janicek's conversion, however reluctant, was thorough enough. The Cavalar took charge almost immediately. Dirk thought that they should leave at once and discuss their plans en route, but Janicek insisted that they take time to shower and dress. If Jan is still alive, he will be safe enough until dawn. The hounds have poor night sight, and the Braiths will not be eager to go blundering into a dark choker wood. No, Telerion, they will camp and wait. A man alone and on foot cannot get far, so we have time enough to meet them like iron jades. By the time they were ready to depart, Janicek had removed almost every trace of his drunken rage. He was slim and immaculate in a suit of fur-lined chameleon cloth, his beard cleaned and trimmed, his dark red hair combed carefully back from his eyes. Only his right arm, scrubbed and carefully bandaged but still conspicuous, gave evidence against him. But the scratches did not seem to have impaired him much. He looked graceful and fluid as he charged and checked his laser and slid it into his belt. In addition to the pistol, Janicek was also carrying a long, double-bladed knife and a rifle like Dirk's. He grinned gleefully as he took it up. Dirk had washed and shaved while waiting, and had also taken the opportunity to eat his first full meal in days. He was feeling almost energetic when they set off for the roof. The interior of Janicek's huge square air car was every bit as cramped as that of the tiny derelict Dirk had flown from Crine Lamia, although Janicek's machine did have four small seats instead of only two. "The armor," Garth said when Dirk remarked on the limited interior space. He strapped Dirk into a rigid, uncomfortable seat with a tight battle harness, did likewise for himself, and took them swiftly aloft. The cabin was dimly lit and completely enclosed, with gauges and instruments everywhere, even above the doors. No windows. A panel of eight small view screens gave the pilot eight different exterior views. The decor was unpainted, unornamented duralloy. "This vehicle is older than both of us," Janicek said as he took them up. He seemed eager enough to talk and friendly in his abrasive sort of way. "And it has seen more worlds than even you. Its history is fascinating. This particular model dates to some 400 standard years ago. It was built by the wisdoms of Dam Tudian, well within the Tempter's Veil, and used in their wars against Erican and Rogue's Hope. After a century or so, it was disabled and abandoned. The Ericaners salvaged it during a peace and sold it to the Steel Angels on Bastion. They used it in a number of campaigns until it was finally captured from them by the Prometheans. A Kimdisi trader picked it up in Prometheus and sold it to me, and I adapted it to the Code Duello. No one has challenged me to aerial combat since. Watch!" His hand reached out and depressed a glowing button, and suddenly there was a surge of acceleration that pressed Dirk back against his seat. "Auxiliary pulse tubes for emergency speed," Janicek said with a grin. "We will be there in less than half the time it took you, Telerion." "Good," Dirk said. Something was nagging at him. "Did you say you got it from a Kimdisi trader?" "That is truth," Janicek said. "The peaceful Kimdisi are great arms traders. I have a scant regard for the manipulators, as you know, but I am not above taking advantage of a bargain when one is offered." "Arkin made a great show of being non-violent," Dirk said. "I suppose that was all another sham." "No," Janicek said. He glanced at Dirk and smiled. "Startled, Telerion? The truth is perhaps more bizarre. We do not call the Kimdisi manipulators without reason. You studied history on Avalon, I assume?" "Some," Dirk said. "Old Earth history, the Federal Empire, the Double War, the expansion." "Yet no outworld history," Janicek clucked. "It is expected. So many worlds and cultures in the Man Realm, so many histories. Even the names are too much to learn. Listen, I will enlighten you. When you landed on Warlorn, did you notice the circle of flags?" Dirk looked at him blankly. "No." "Perhaps they are no longer in place. Once, though, during the festival itself, the plaza outside the spacefield flew 14 flags. It was an absurd Tiberian conceit, yet it came to pass in a fashion. Though the planetary flags in 10 of the 14 cases represented nothing, worlds like Eshelin and the Forgotten Colony did not even know what a flag was, while at the other extreme the Amreli had a different banner for each of their 100 urban towers. The Darklings laughed at us all and flew a cloth of solid black. He seemed very amused at that. As for High Cavalan, we had no flag for all our world. We found one, though. It was taken from history, a rectangle divided into 4 quadrants of different colors. A green banshee on a field of black for Iron Jade, Shanigate's silver hunting bat on yellow, crossed swords against crimson for red steel, and for Braith a white wolf on purple. It was the old standard of the High Bond League. The League was created about the time that the starships first returned to High Cavalan. There was a man, a great leader, named Vicar High Redsteel Corbin. He dominated Redsteel's High Bond Council for a generation, and when the Offworlders came he was convinced that all Cavalars must band together to share knowledge and wealth equally. Thus he formed the High Bond League, whose flag I have described to you. The union was sadly short-lived. Kimdisi traders, fearful of the power of a unified High Cavalan, contracted to provide modern armaments exclusively to the Braiths. The Braith Highbonds had joined the League only from fear. In truth, they wished to shun the stars, which they avowed were all full of mockmen. Yet they did not shrink from taking mockman lasers. So we had the last High War. Iron Jade and Red Steel and Shanigate together subjugated Braith, despite the Kimdisi arms. But Vicar High Redsteel himself was killed, and the cost in lives was hideous. The High Bond League outlasted its founder by only a handful of years. Braith, badly beaten, fastened onto the belief that it had been tricked and used by Kimdisi mockmen, and thus cleaved to the old traditions even more firmly than before. To blood the peace and make it lasting, the League, now dominated by High Bonds from Shanigate, seized all the Kimdisi traders on High Cavalan and a ship of the Tiberians as well, declared all of them to be war criminals, a term the Offworlders taught us, by the way, and set them free on the plains to be hunted as mockmen. Banshees killed many of them, others starved, but the hunters took the most and carried their heads home for trophies. It is said that the Braith High Bonds took special joy in flaying the men who had armed and advised them. We are not proud of that hunt overmuch today, yet we can understand it. The war had been long and bloodier than any in our history since the time of fire and demons. It was a time of great griefs and towering hatreds, and it destroyed the High Bond League. The Iron Jade Gathering withdrew rather than condone the hunting, declaring that the Kimdisi were human. Red Steel soon followed. The Mockman killers were all Braiths and Shanigates, and the Shanigate holding was thenceforth leagued only to itself. Vicar's banner was soon abandoned and forgotten, until the festival caused us to remember it. Janicek paused and glanced toward Dirk. Can you see the truth now, Telerion? I can see why Cavalars and Kimdisi don't like each other much, Dirk admitted. Janicek laughed. It goes beyond our own history, he said. Kimdis has fought no wars, but the world has bloody hands. When Tober in the Vale attacked Wolfheim, the Manipulator supplied both sides. When civil war flared on I Emerel between the Urbanites, whose universe is a single building, and the disaffected Starseekers who urged a broader horizon, Kimdis was deeply involved, giving the Urbanites the means to win conclusively. He grinned. In truth, Telerion, there are even tales of Kimdisi plots within the Tempter's Vale. It is said it was the Kimdisi agents who set the Steel Angels and the Altered Men of Prometheus against each other, who deposed the fourth Cuchulain of Tara because he refused to trade with them, who interfered on Brak to keep technology stillborn beneath the weight of the Braki priests. Do you know the ancient religion of Kimdis? No. You would approve, Janicek said. It is a peaceful and civilized creed, exceedingly complex. You can use it to justify anything except personal violence. Yet their great prophet, the son of the dreamer, accepted as a myth figure, but they continue to revere him. He said once, "Remember, your enemy has an enemy." Indeed he does. That is the heart of Kimdisi wisdom. Dirk shifted uneasily in his seat. Are you saying that Ruark...
I'm saying nothing,
Janasek interrupted. Draw your own conclusions. You need not accept mine. I told all of this to Gwen Dalvano once because she stood Crow Bethen to me and I had a concern. She was vastly amused. The history meant nothing, she told me. Arkan Ruark was only himself, not some archetype of outworld history, so she informed me. He was also her friend, I was told, and this bond, this friendship, his voice was acid as he said the word, somehow transcended the fact that he was a liar and a Kimdisi. Gwen told me to look to my own history. If Arkan Ruark was a manipulator by mere fact of birth on Kimdis, then I was a taker of Mokman heads by simple virtue of being Kavalar. Dirk considered that. She was right, you know, he said quietly. Oh, was she? Her argument was right, Dirk said. It seems as though she was wrong in her assessment of Ruark, but in general... In general, it is better to distrust all Kimdisi, Janasek said firmly. You have been deceived and used, Telerion, yet you do not learn. You are very like Gwen. Enough of this. He tapped one of the view screens with a knuckle. We have the mountains close at hand. It will not be long now. Dirk had been gripping his laser rifle very tightly. He wiped his sweating palms on his trousers. You have a plan? Yes, said Janasek, grinning. And at that he leaned across the space between them and smoothly snatched the laser from off Dirk's lap. A very simple plan, in truth, he continued, setting the weapon down carefully out of reach. I will hand you over to Lorimar.